We have an amazing verse. Ascharyavat pasyati. Ascharyavat pasyati ke charenam. Ascharyavat vadati tataiva chanya. Ascharyavat chainam. Anya shrinoti. Shrutvapi enam veda. Nachaiva kaschit. Ascharyavat pasyati kaschirenam. Ascharyavat vadati tataiva chanya. Ascharyavat chainam. Anya shrinoti. Shrutvapi enam veda. Nachaiva kaschit. Some look on the soul as amazing. Some describe him as amazing. Some hear of him as amazing. While others, even after hearing about him, cannot understand him at all. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Om Ajnanatimirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshurumilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Karamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Saminiti Namine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunabadi Paschatya Deshatarine Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
So, we truly have an amazing verse here today. What's amazing about this verse today?
How many times it says amazing?
That's amazing, right? What is the amazing thing in this verse? What is being described as being amazing?
The soul.
The soul, yes. The soul is being described as being amazing. Now, I wonder, why is the soul amazing? What's amazing about it?
Because it never dies.
Okay, that's an amazing thing about it. What else is amazing about the soul?
Doesn't have a start and it doesn't have an end.
Yeah, it doesn't have a start and it doesn't have an end. That's amazing about it.
It's there and we cannot see it.
What's that?
It's there and we cannot see it.
Yeah, it's there and we cannot see it. This is the last verse, or the next to the last verse, really, of a whole section where Krishna talks about the nature of the soul. It started with verse 10 in the second chapter. The first nine verses, Arjuna came up with some more doubts that he had, and then he surrenders to Krishna. And then Krishna begins to speak. And so from verse 10 through verse 30, this is verse 29, so there's one more verse. From verse 10 to verse 30,
there's a whole description of the soul, many different things about it. So maybe you all have been reading a little bit about the soul. What kind of things has Krishna said about the soul in these 20 verses from verse 10 to verse 30? Does anybody remember any of those in-between verses that Krishna described the soul?
Is there, like, fire cannot burn it,
and, right.
and water cannot, I don't know.
Moisten it,
or,
right.
Yeah.
It cannot be withered by the wind, right? What else did we hear about
inconceivable,
this? Was that?
Inconceivable.
Yeah.
Weapons cannot kill.
Right. That's being described as the soul. What else did Krishna say about the soul?
Everlasting and unborn.
Yeah. For the soul, there's neither birth nor death. At any time, he has not come into being. He has not come into being. He will not come into being. We find out that as one puts on garments, giving up old and worn out garments, one accepts a soul in the same way. We find out that as one is changing even in this body, from a boy body to a man body to an old man body, so similarly at death, we will also change into another body. In other words, we're already reincarnating even before we die, because we have little body. All of us had little bodies one time, and now we've got big bodies, and then we'll get old shriveled up bodies soon. And so the body changes even while we're alive, and then at the time of death, we get a complete refurb, whole new body altogether. It looks different, maybe even speaks a different language, all kinds of differences. So we're hearing all these things about the body. And this section of Bhagavad Gita is sometimes called the Sankhya Yoga section, because Krishna's telling about Sankhya, or the nature of things, how it works. And what's really interesting is Krishna starts his explanation to Arjuna with this idea that we're not the body. That's the first thing he tells Arjuna. So that's a very important thing. Because if we think we're the body, then we find that spiritual life is very difficult to understand. And we see that there are people in the world who do not have a conception of the difference between the body and the soul. And some of these people are even religious or spiritual people. Not that they're, certainly atheists don't believe that there's a difference between the body and the soul. In fact, most atheists believe there is no such thing as a soul. And many spiritual people think that there must be some kind of spirit within the body, but they're not clear what the spirit is or how it works. And so there's a lot of misunderstanding about the nature of the soul and the nature of the body. But Krishna clears that all up. Basically, in 20 verses, he describes a lot of things that the soul cannot be cut, cannot be dried, he cannot be withered by the wind or burned by fire, any of these things. The soul is eternal, unborn, undying, primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. Only the body is destroyed, but the soul is not destroyed. And we find out that as we put on clothes, when we get old, worn-out clothes, we take them off and we get new clothes. So we get an old, worn-out body, we take it off, and we get a new body, and that's called reincarnation. And this idea of reincarnation explains many things in the world around us. And without this idea of reincarnation, even if we believe in God, we find things very mysterious. And that's why
many people of many religions who don't accept reincarnation but do accept God have a very fuzzy and strange idea about the nature of the soul. So Krishna is saying that some look on the soul, I think the word, the verb is pasyati, that's the standard Sanskrit word for to see, or to experience through the eyes, pasyati, to see. Vadati, that's the Sanskrit word for to speak, or so some people speak about the soul, it's amazing. And then we have,
how do they put it here?
Srinoti.
Yeah, Srinoti, right, hears of.
So some Srinoti is to hear about. So some Pasyati, some Vadati, and some Srinoti. Some hear of him, some speak of him, and some see him as amazing. And then others can't comprehend at all. They don't, you can explain about the soul, they either don't believe it or they can't grasp it. Either of those two things. I forget, there was some famous English philosopher that said that if I was supposed to describe the Western world, I would describe it as that place where people have no concept of reincarnation. He described it like that, you know, that because without reincarnation, nothing makes sense about this world. We see things happen, and they seem meaningless. We find that horrible things happen to even children, as you all know here in Connecticut. Just recently, it was that big episode. So suddenly something very devastating can happen even to small children, and we wonder, why is it happening to small children who haven't done anything wicked in their lives yet? Doesn't make any sense. Why are some children born in very wealthy families? Other children are born in very poverty-stricken families. And of course, many people feel that, well, whatever religion we follow is the only true religion. But they never stop to think what would have happened if they'd been born on the other side of the planet, in someone else's womb, and had been born to parents that were not maybe Christians, but were maybe Hindu, or maybe their parents were Buddhist, or possibly they were Muslim or something like that, then they would have been born to a Muslim mother or a Buddhist mother or a Hindu mother, and they would have had a very different sense of spiritual life. Or maybe they could have been born even to an atheist mother, and mother would have been not interested in God even slightly. So it's obvious this would have a big impact on your spiritual upbringing, on your sense of God. But this is not explained. Why does God allow people to be born in Muslim families or Hindu families or Buddhist families if Christianity is the right way? You know, they're given a wrong start right from the beginning. So these things don't make sense. There's no explanation for them. And whenever people from various religious backgrounds that don't accept reincarnation hear about these things, they have no easy way to explain it. Now, Buddhism does accept reincarnation to some extent, but in a different way than we do. And religion, or the Jews, they also accept reincarnation, at least some of them do, to a certain extent. The idea is there. So when we see that even at the very beginning of life, already things are not equal, then it's an indication that before this life, there must have been a previous life, where now, as a result of the previous life, we have the situation of this present life. And this is called reincarnation, and called bringing the karma from one lifetime into another. That's why one child is born in a wealthy family, another child is born in an unwealthy family. Why one child is born in a Christian family, one is born in a Jewish family, one is born in some other kind of religious background. This is all because of a previous life. And now it doesn't seem like such a raw deal. Why is it that God plays some kind of roulette with children being born, and some get all these advantages and some get so many disadvantages? We know that it's because of the cycle of reincarnation. The child had a previous life. And we see that even at the very beginning, early stages of life, many children already have a very developed sense of what they want to do with their lives. Some children just like sports. Some children just like to read. Some children are very open and social. Some are very withdrawn. Some want to be involved in music. And some could care less about music. Some are very intelligent about science or math. And some are very intelligent about business or something else. Why is it so different? Why do we have all these various differences? And the answer is that each time we have a life, the things that happen in that life make impressions on the mind, and those are called samskaras. So when we take a new lifetime, we have a new body, but the subtle body is not new. The subtle body is the same subtle body that we had in the previous lifetime. And although, for the most part, the memories are gone, but the impressions, the samskaras, are there. And so when the child starts to get older, the child begins to awaken to those impressions and patterns that are already coming from a past lifetime. And so one child studies all kinds of philosophy. Another child, all they can think about is playing basketball. Another child thinks about joining the military at a very early age, you know. So these impressions are there, and they come out. And then the child begins to take a very different course in life. So not only are their karmas different, what their advantages and disadvantages are, not only are those things different, but also their desires are different, their direction in life is different, their view of the world is different, and so forth. So this is the effect of karma. So what are the, let me ask a simple question. What are the evidences of good karma? If someone has good karma, what kind of things do we see in their lives? What are the effects of good karma? Somebody tell me one of the effects of good karma.
Good things will happen to you in return.
Good things, yeah. What kind of good things? That's what I'm trying to get at. Specifically, what kind of good things? Usually when there are in the Vedic literatures, it explains there are certain kinds of examples or earmarks of good karma. What are some of those things that we know then, therefore, that somebody has good karma?
A person takes birth in a rich family.
Rich family. Well, wealth is an example of good karma. What's another example of good karma?
Beauty,
right. So, Shri or beauty is considered an example of good karma.
Education.
Education is considered a product of good karma. So, what else?
Fame or adoration?
Fame, being famous. When somebody is very famous, they're born into a famous family or they become famous very soon in life, that's an example of good karma. So we've got most of them. There's maybe one or two more we haven't mentioned yet.
You could be born in a family that's in Krishna consciousness.
Well, yeah, that's beyond good karma. That's spiritual. That's a different thing. That's actually beyond good karma.
And in general, enjoy good health.
Good health. Okay, that was the one that we didn't get so far. Good health, right. So the Janmayeshvarya Shruta Shrivir, you know, so these are health, wealth, fame, beauty, getting some kind of good education, good family. These are all examples of good karma. What then are examples of bad karma?
Being poor.
Being poor, right. We can just reverse them. What's another example of having bad karma?
Poor health.
Oh, sorry. What's that?
Poor health.
Poor health, right. poor health. What's another example of bad
karma? Being ugly.
Being ugly, yeah. Like me.
Like me.
What's another example?
Not being famous.
Not being famous, right. Being run of the mill.
Or even bad thoughts.
What's that?
Negative thoughts being bad.
Yeah, that's also actually a part of bad karma that comes from it. But you get the idea that these are examples of good karma, being famous, wealthy, being attractive, being healthy, and so on and so forth. All these are good education. These are all examples of good karma. And the opposite are examples of bad karma. Of course, neither good karma nor bad karma will make any difference to whether you become spiritually inclined or not. There's no such thing as having so bad karma that you can't become involved in spiritual life, nor is there such a thing as having such a good karma that because you have such a good karma, you will become involved in spiritual life. It's a different category altogether. So this idea of going from one lifetime to another and bringing our karma with us, bringing our samskaras or impressions with us, is a very important understanding. And the soul suffers or enjoys the good karma or the bad karma that we bring with us. And for most of us, we bring both good and bad karma. We don't have completely good karma, we don't have completely bad karma. We have a nice mixture of both. So that's why, you know, if we all had great karma, we would all look very beautiful and we would all be very powerful and wealthy and intelligent and so forth. We'd be in the heavenly planets where basically the demigods are like that. They have long lives, they're all famous, they're all very attractive. None of the demigods wear glasses or have to use hearing aids or any of those kind of things. They are all very knowledgeable, especially in the Vedas. You know, they have great intelligence. So this is the demigods. But most of us don't make that grade, so we have some good karma and some bad karma. Now, some people may wonder, or it's actually interesting, that since probably, or at least it became more obvious, about the turn of the century, you know, the late 1800s, not this, I should say the turn of the last century, the late 1800s, the beginning of the 20th centuries, we find that many philosophers began to think more and more in terms of there being no such thing as a soul, that this world is only what we see, and there is no voodoo outside of that. You know, there's no such thing as a soul. There's no such thing as God. There's no such thing as an afterlife. These are all things that childish people believe in. You were going to ask a question.
Would karma even be breath?
What's that?
The breath.
Not exactly. No, that's prana. That's a different kind of thing. But this idea that there is no nothing outside just the things that we see and hear every day. This is basically what we call materialism. Materialism can mean that there is nothing other than matter, That's one definition of materialism, that matter is everything. There's nothing outside of matter. Another definition of materialism is that matter is the most important thing. In other words, making money and getting things material is the most important thing. That's another type of materialism. And these two types of materialism are related, but they're not exactly the same thing. And so we have people and philosophers who say that there is no such thing as a soul. I think Francis Crick and his associates, when they discovered the DNA, they made some kind of also statement about the fact that this idea that we call consciousness actually is a complete fiction. It doesn't exist. That the consciousness is only the electrical energy going on in the brain, and it's nothing more than that. And technically, that's known as epiphenomenalism, that there is nothing more to the human being, nothing more to his thoughts, nothing more to his life than electrical impulses dancing along the neurons in the brain. That's basically all there is. There's nothing beyond that. Of course, most religious people don't accept that, but they don't actually know what the soul is. Some think that the body is the soul. In fact, many Christian denominations think that the body, when it dies, it will go into the earth and maybe it'll rot. But when the second coming comes, then the body will be reassembled and we will go to heaven in that reassembled body. Of course, that's kind of strange when you think that maybe some people didn't have such a nice-looking body and maybe they'd like to get a different model or something like that. But I don't guess there's any scope for that. You get the one that you got, you know, when you came out of the womb. And that one is the one that you spend eternity in. So that's one idea. Another is that there is a soul, but that soul is formless. And without the body, that soul can't express itself. It needs the body. So we have to have a body and we have to have a soul. So that without the soul, the body doesn't work. And without the body, the soul doesn't work. So that's another concept. Another concept is that we are all part of the oversoul. And when we die, like a little drop, we merge back into the waters of the great ocean of the Brahman. And in that way, we cease to exist. So some think like that. And so there's a number of these various concepts. But here in Bhagavad Gita, we learn very distinctly what the nature of the soul really is. The soul is a separate thing. It is within the body. There were scientists, or rather I should say philosophers, some years ago, maybe some centuries ago, that thought the idea, well, what if we say that within the brain there's a little man? You can imagine a little man sitting in a control room in the brain. And he's got a television screen in there, and he's got some speakers. And he's listening to what comes in the ears, and he's watching on his television screen what comes in the eyes. And so if we look at this little man sitting inside the body, controlling the body with little levers, then we have to ask the question, well, does that little man have a little man inside him? And then we can ask the question, does that little man have a little man inside him? And so this led to a great philosophical problem that they called the homunculus. There's a name for it. And so they said that, therefore, there cannot be a soul. This was given as a proof that there couldn't be a soul, because if there was a little man within our consciousness that was watching what we do, that little man, then we could ask the question, well, maybe there's a little man inside him, and if there's a little man inside him, then it goes back and back. And where does it stop? We don't have any answer for that. Of course, we do have an answer for that. The Vedic literature explains that the soul is not made the same way that the body is. The body is a machine. It's described as a machine. And the consciousness, the soul, is actually a fully integrated being. The soul is not made of earth, water, fire, air, ether, or even mind, intelligence, and false ego. The soul is made of Sat-Chit-Ananda. The soul is made of a different substance than the body is. And the soul is integrated. So there's no difference between the mind of the soul and the body of the soul. There's no difference. It's the same thing. So it's not a separate thing. So the little man within the big man is just one step there. That's all there is. First there is the subtle body inside the gross body. And then there is the soul, which is in the subtle body. These things are described in a nice analogy in the Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a story of King Paranjana in the city of Nine Gates. So the body is given a very picturesque, or a, I should say not picturesque, but pictorial description. It's given as an analogy of a city. And the city has nine gates. You have a question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it because the soul is made of different material, that's why it can't be like, it can't be disrupted by any material?
Yeah, yeah, it's made of a different material, right.
And the body can.
The body can't. There's nothing that can destroy Sat-Chit-Ananda. That's, you know, eternality, bliss, and knowledge. That's what the spiritual world is made of. You can't destroy that kind of thing. But you can destroy earth, water, fire, air, ether. Those things are designed, but they will be destroyed at some point. And the body just drives them. I mean, the soul drives them like a person drives a car. So we get in a car, and we don't think we are the car. We think we're the driver of the car. And the car is made of metal and things, and our bodies are made of very different things. It's not made of metal and wires. It's made of flesh and blood. And so we are also even different than the car. We're even different than the body. We're made out of Sat-Chit-Ananda, which is a different thing. And we're driving the body. And at a certain point, the body gets too old, and we have to leave it. But we don't, like an ejection seat, we have something that leaves the body with us. The soul doesn't just leave the body by itself. The soul is also in a capsule, and that capsule is called the subtle body. The subtle body is made of mind, intelligence, and false ego. And in Sanskrit, that's called the linga sharira. Whereas the gross body, this thing is called the sthula sharira. So this thing certainly disintegrates when the subtle body leaves. But the subtle body continues to go on and reincarnate again and again until we dissolve the subtle body. And the subtle body is dissolved by devotional service. That's how it's dissolved. And when we dissolve the subtle body, then when we leave this body, there's no subtle body which is causing a new gross body. Instead, we go back to the spiritual world. So the linga sharira is made of mind, intelligence, and false ego. These three things carry us from one body to another. That's the thing that is the vehicle that takes us from one body to another. And the soul does not need the gross body. The soul does not need the subtle body. The soul is perfect in itself, but the soul is misidentifying with the subtle body, and because the soul misidentifies with the subtle body, we get a new gross body. And so in this way we go through the cycle of reincarnation. And, you know, someone may ask, well, is there any evidence of any of this kind of thing taking place? We would like to see some evidence. And it turns out that there is evidence that sometimes children spontaneously remember their past life. They're actually, not many children do this, but some do. Actually, I wanted to show this book. There's two of them, actually.
All right.
There's this book here called 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation. And this book is written by a psychologist. His name is Dr. Ian Stevenson. He's no longer living. Let's see if there's a picture of him in here. If you see a picture of him, he looks a lot like Rompad Swami, almost. I was surprised when I saw a picture of him. This looks like a picture of Rompad Swami, but he looks really similar. But he has, he's no longer living. He died about 5 or 6 years ago or something like that. And he studied cases of children reporting that they had a previous lifetime. So the reason he studied children was because children can't make up a good story that's tight and plausible, you know. So if a child says, I was somebody in a previous life, and he's making it up, he can't make up a good, reasonable story that's believable. But these children that Ian Stevenson interviewed, many of them actually had very believable stories, and even they knew names of people in the previous family. They knew sometimes bits of language in the previous family. What Ian Stevenson hoped to do was to make a huge file of these kind of reports of children remembering past lifetimes, and he hoped that scientists would take the idea of reincarnation seriously, because he was a scientist. You know, Ian Stevenson was a practicing psychologist, or a psychiatrist, I don't remember which it was.
He's doing MD.
So MD, yeah, I know, but that doesn't tell me whether he's a psychologist or a psychiatrist. So. But at any rate, he, you know, what's interesting, he had to get interpreters, because sometimes he interviewed children in, you know, way north of India, you know, and in Kashmir and places like that. He interviewed children in South India. He interviewed children where, you know, one little girl would sing songs in Bengali, but she was actually Gujarati and had never been to Bengal in her life, you know, and things like that. So you have these kind of strange things. And sometimes the children did not want to eat with their family because they remembered that they were Brahmins in the past lifetime, and their present family was either Vaishya or some other caste, and they felt that they didn't want to eat with their family members. So you can imagine what kind of difficulty this caused for the family. Yeah, there's even Stevenson. Somebody's got him up on there. Yeah.
Psychiatrist.
So, also, oftentimes when the children remember their past lifetime, they remember how they died. And oftentimes that death was a murder or something like that. So they want to get that information of their past life to the people of their previous family, and so on and so forth. So, Ian Stevenson logged in some 2,000 cases in India, and then people said, well, naturally in India people believe this thing. Does anybody have these kind of episodes other than India? So he went to Europe and America, and he found also in European countries and American countries, children also remember sometimes their past lives. And he wrote down what the children said, and where the supposed family was. They would give a name, they would give a location, they would explain who their husband was in the previous life, what his name was, what kind of work he did, what kind of food he liked, what kind of food he didn't like. And, you know, this is the kind of things that a, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 year old child would explain about some family far away that they had never met, that has, you know, was sometimes 20 or 100 or 1,000 miles away, and they would describe these things. And then Ian Stevenson and his group would go interview the second family. And sometimes the children would demand to meet the original family or the family they had in their past lifetime. And of course, the present family was always kind of a little bit bothered by that, that they would say, this is my real family, you know, and so on and so forth. So you got all these kind of unusual social things that would take place. And it turns out that usually from about age 6 to about age 10, that's when this memory of past life would peak. And then after that, it kind of subsides. Oftentimes, it becomes less important, and the child would just move into the present life after that. So overall, he had about 5,000 cases or something. So that's not a small number. And this is written like a science textbook, you know. It's got graphs, and it's got, you know, what he spoke to, and how the child claims he died, and then he talks to the, you know, living brother now, and he explains that, yes, my brother died this way, the way the child explains it, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of evidence, really, that this is not just some mental thing, but that people, not, you know, not all children, in fact, most children don't remember their past lives, but some do. And when they do, it's usually a problem for the present family, and sometimes it can be a problem for the past family, because they can point out who it was that was a murderer in the past lifetime. And there was one story where, in this, where Ian Stevenson did an interview with one man who, he was murdered by someone who owed him money in the past lifetime. So he had some business, and he lent somebody some money. And then the person that owed him the money couldn't pay or didn't want to pay, so they arranged for him to be murdered.
It was in India?
Yes, it was in India.
I heard that.
And then he went, and he tried to collect the debt now in a new bond.
Wow.
And the man, he said that if he wanted to, he could press, you know, murder charges. So the man in the previous body did actually give him some of the money back, you know. So this was kind of collecting a debt from a previous lifetime. But, you know, that's just one of the kind of things that can happen. What's interesting is there's this book, which is called Soul Survivor, which is a story about a young American boy who was born to, his name was, I think, James Leninger. And his parents, Andrea and, what was his name, Bruce Leninger, that's his father's name, Bruce Leninger. They found out that when this little boy was very little, he had nightmares all the time. And they couldn't figure out why he had nightmares. In fact, he had nightmares every night, and they couldn't sleep even, because every night he would just wake up screaming and so on and so forth. Then his mother, Andrea Leninger, talked to the little boy, and she said, what's happening? And he said, little man crash in plane, little man burn up. And she said, little man burning up, crashing in plane. You're in an airplane? And he says, yes, I'm in an airplane, and the airplane is crashing. She said, why is it crashing? And he said, because it was shot down. She said, it was shot down? Who was it shot down by? And he says, the Japanese. And so the little boy starts having these nightmares, or in fact he has them from very early age, about being a World War II fighter pilot in the Japanese theater. You know, he was stationed in Japan, and he was shot down by the Japanese military on one of the last missions that he had to go on. He was almost finished being, finished with his tour of duty, and he would have been able to come back to the United States. But instead, he went on one more mission. On that mission, he was killed. And so this little boy would explain these details about this
idea of being a fighter pilot in World War II. And his father, Bruce Leninger, they were Christians, and his mother, Andrea, said, well, maybe he's reincarnated, but his father didn't believe that. He said, no, there's no such thing as reincarnation. But he began to write down what his son would say. And because his son was saying things that were historically verifiable, he was going to check out to see if any of the things that his son said are actually historically verified somewhere. So his son said that his name was James. This is what confused the parents for a while, because in his present life his name is James, and his past life his name was also James. So at first they thought that he was just doing something strange. Then it turns out that the little boy said, no, in the past life his name was James Huston, and that he was a fighter pilot, and he flew a certain kind of airplane called a Corsair, which most people don't even know about that. You know, it's a rare kind of World War II plane. Most of them were other kinds, like P-52s. There was a lot of more usual used aircraft, but he flew a Corsair. And then when his father, Bruce, went into the records, he saw that there was a squadron that flew Corsairs, and the little boy said, I flew off of a ship called the Natoma Bay. And then Bruce did research into, you know, World War II history and found out there was a ship called the Natoma Bay. And what's kind of funny is that the more he heard about this, he was eager to find out if any of the people who the little boy claimed were his fellow fighter pilots were still living. So Bruce, he contacted the World War II Veterans Society, and he found out there was a group that was on the Natoma Bay, and they would meet every several years in California. And he contacted them and asked if he could come to one of their meetings. He said that he was writing a book on World War II. He didn't want to tell them why he was actually interested in this story. You know, he told them, I'm writing a book on World War II and the pilots of World War II, and I'd like to interview some of you. So they said, yeah, please come on out. We meet at, you know, we're meeting in California in this place at this time. And so he went out there, and then he asked them about this James Huston. And some of them knew James, and they told a story about James and this and that and the other thing. And then he met them, I think, two or three times he went out there. And then finally one day at the breakfast that they were having together, he said, I have to... I have a confession to make that the reason I'm here, I know you'll all think I'm crazy, is that my little boy claims to be a fighter pilot that flew on the Natoma Bay. And so then, you know, they said, well, maybe that's what's happening, you know. So over a period of about two or three years, the little boy gives so many details about his previous life that his father begins to find very little argument that this boy doesn't actually understand what he was in the past lifetime. And there was a television station that heard about the story, and they wanted to come out and interview the boy and do a television explanation of his life. Actually, the interviewer, the lady that actually heard about it and wanted to do it, was an Indian lady. And so she wanted to come out and do a story with them. They got all the information together for the television story. And then the television network decided not to show it. And
the religious?
Was that? This was about, I think, 7-8 years ago. And then about 2 years later, the same Indian lady went to ABC from the company that she was before that. And she told them about the same story, and they did want to show it. So they went back and got all this stuff. And now 2 years had gone by, you know, so they interviewed the family again. And this time it actually was put on ABC television. And you can see it on the internet, the story of the Leningers and this little boy and his story with World War II. And what's even more interesting is that some Japanese television network people saw the story in America, and they thought, well, let's bring the boy back to the place where he says he died, which was Chichijima in Japan. And then it went on Japanese television, you know, and they discussed the boy's life on Japanese television. And the boy went out on a little boat. Next to there was a big rock, you know, and he was very vivid about how he had just about managed to turn around, but a shell hit the engine compartment of his airplane, and he crashed right at the base of this big rock that's right there at a very noticeable part of Chichijima. And so the Japanese television company rented a boat, and they went out there. And the people that were part of the veterans, the Second World War veterans, they also described that this is how James Houston died, the two stories linked up. And when little James Leninger went out there, he just started crying uncontrollably. And then after that, kind of the whole thing just kind of ended in his life. He kind of, that was the end of his connection with his past life. He did speak about it again, but it became less and less a thing. That was kind of the event that brought his whole previous life to a close. There's many more things about it, and this story is really kind of fascinating to read if you're ever interested in checking it out.
I have seen that whole episode on television.
Yeah. So they decided eventually, because James, Bruce Leninger, the father, he said, you know, I told you all that I was writing a story about World War II, and I think I should write a story. So instead he wrote this book. And this book was released by the parents. So anyway, so there, you had a question?
I wanted to ask, is he still alive?
Who?
James.
Yeah. The boy is still alive. He's now getting, I think, in his teens or something like that, or in the family. They lived in many different places. And so anyway, what we're seeing here is that there are examples of people who remember past lives, and you can connect with their stories, understand them, and then therefore we have some evidence that this isn't just some kind of idea, that it really does happen. This amazing soul goes from one lifetime to another lifetime, and sometimes has unfinished business from one lifetime in a new lifetime, and certainly always brings karma from one lifetime to another lifetime. And many people who are not at all spiritually oriented will just write this off, especially if people are very materialistic. If a person is very materialistic, then they just think that this must be some kind of very simplistic thinking, or some kind of pre-scientific view that only very gullible people would hold. But it's not like that. There is evidence that people have past lives. Of course, one other thing that I could mention is that the beginning of this century, last century rather, the 20th century, around the early 1900s, there was a group of psychologists, and they discovered that people would have traumas in early life, and they could keep over, or these traumas would continue into later life. And so they discovered that by hypnotizing people and bringing them to their early childhood, that they could sometimes discover things that caused them to be dysfunctional as full adults. You know, they would have something happen to them as a small child, or as even an adolescent, and it was so traumatic that they would block it out of their minds, but they would not be able to function properly as human beings later on. They would have some kind of neuroses, or they would have some kind of unreasonable fear, irrational fear of things. And so these psychologists would cause through hypnosis the person to regress into an early part of their childhood. And then they would sometimes understand what it was that shocked a child at an early age. And when the child could understand that, and when they could recognize what they had said, they would play the tape back, then the difficulties would go away. But sometimes something very strange would happen. These psychologists who were doing these hypnotic regressions would back the child up too far, and they would go previous to birth, back into a previous lifetime. And many of them didn't know what to make of that, you know, that that was something they hadn't expected, that people would not only remember early parts of their life through hypnosis, but they could be backed up further to where they would remember previous lifetimes. And at first, they didn't, nobody talked about this, but then on some seminars, when these different psychologists would get together, they realized they were all having the same experience, that they were sometimes hypnotically regressing their patients back before into a previous lifetime, and they hadn't communicated about it before. And so then this whole concept of previous life regression became born, this whole concept of regressing people into previous lifetimes. And again, just like this thing with the children, we could find out even details of previous lifetimes and what kind of job they did, where they worked. And sometimes the previous lifetime was halfway across the planet. In one situation, the idea of backing up somebody in a previous lifetime will sometimes mean that they'll suddenly start speaking a different language, a language they don't know in their present consciousness. And that's called xenoglossy. So someone, there's a famous thing you can see also on the internet pretty easily by Peter Ramster. He hypnotizes three ladies who live in Australia, and they've never been out of Australia in their entire lives. They're three housewives that live in Australia. One of them remembers a life as a lady in Scotland or Ireland somewhere, and one of them remembers a life as a man in France as a scientist of some kind or another, and one of them remembers a life as a little girl in Nazi occupation, you know. So the one that's remembering, you know, the life as a man in France, she suddenly begins to speak French. She doesn't speak French, and she's never learned the language in her waking consciousness. But when she gets put into hypnotic regression, suddenly this other language comes out. And what's even more unusual is it's not modern French that she's speaking. She's speaking an old dialect of French, and they have to bring in a special interpreter that not only understands French, but understands an older version of French. So these kind of things give us indication that something very strange is going on here. And the most simple way to describe it is that someone is just being connected with their past lifetimes in some way or another. And people can refuse to believe it, and many people do, because they don't want to think that there's such a thing as a God. They don't want to think that there's such a thing as a soul. They don't want to think there's such a thing as another lifetime, or so on and so forth. They would rather believe there's just one lifetime, and that whatever I like to do, I can do it, and it doesn't matter because when I die, that's it, you know. But there's strong evidence that this is not, in fact, true, that there is such a thing as carryovers from one lifetime to another, either through hypnotic regression or sometimes a spontaneous memory of children. There are other things, too, that we don't really have time to talk about. But I just wanted to bring this up because Krishna gives many practical explanations of what the soul is. We've talked a little bit about it, that there's the gross body, and inside the gross body, in the heart, there's the subtle body. The subtle body works through the life airs and manipulates the gross body. That's the levers and pulleys that actually make the gross body move. That there's the subtle body. When the subtle body moves from one lifetime to another, or when someone commits suicide, just the subtle body is what we call a ghost, where there's just a subtle body and there's no gross body. There's still a form. There's still mind, intelligence, and false ego, but now there's no gross body. So the subtle body, when it unites with another gross body, becomes another individual in a regular gross body. But before that happens, or sometimes when someone commits suicide or has a very violent death, then the subtle body does not get a new gross body, but remains as only a subtle body for some time. And that's what we call a ghost. And when the life airs are moved or manipulated by the subtle body, it manipulates the gross body. And, of course, when we engage in devotional service, little by little, we dissolve the subtle body. And when we leave this gross body, then we don't have a new gross body to come back to. Instead, we go back to the spiritual world. So that's an amazing thing. So as we were discussing today, the soul is amazing in a number of ways, how it moves, how it works, how it transfers from one lifetime to another. The fact that the subtle body can remain as a ghost for some time. The fact that impressions of previous lifetimes can still remain and be accessed by hypnotic regression and sometimes spontaneously by children. Oh, you had a question?
Yes.
Okay.
Maharaj, thank you very much for
amazing
bringing this. Yeah. I was thinking that Krishna said, whatever our mentality will be at the time of death,
yeah,
we will get that right without failure.
Yam yam vapi smaram bhavam chajante antikaya.
So, is there any correlation to that statement?
Well,
because I was thinking that James died in World War II.
True, yeah.
And then he remembered there might be another lifetime between his life and his that life.
Well, in the book, it actually talks about the time when he was in heaven, which to me suggests that maybe he was in the heavenly planets for a while, because we know from Mahabharata, when someone dies in a war as a soldier, they're immediately promoted to heaven,
yeah,
no matter which side they die on.
Yeah.
They go to heaven. So obviously he did that. And, you know, at one point, Bruce is talking to his son, James, and he says, I'm so happy now that you are my son. And the little boy says to his father, I knew you would be a good father. That's why I picked you. And I looked down from heaven. He said, the boy said that, yeah. So possibly the little boy didn't want to stay in heaven as long as he did. He wanted to go back to the earth plane for whatever reason. And he then, instead of staying there for thousands of years like people usually do in the heavenly worlds, he reincarnated in the earth plane again, and this time as the son of this Bruce Leninger. You had a question, yeah.
When you were talking about ghosts, mm-hmm. People say that when they see ghosts, ghosts try to scare them.
Mm-hmm.
That, why do the ghosts
Why do the ghosts try to scare them? Because ghosts are very frustrated. Usually a person becomes a ghost because they're very sinful or they commit suicide. And so the punishment for committing suicide and sometimes being very sinful is you don't get a new gross body. So you see the world just like you and I see it, but you can't
interact with the world. You want to eat, but you can't eat. You see other people having fun, but you are in a ghostly body, so you can't touch them, you can't interact with them, and you get very frustrated. But there's one thing you can do, and that thing is that you can play with people's minds. And so ghosts use their psychic energy to create fear in people, or sometimes they actually, if they're more powerful, they can even move material objects around a little bit. Not so much, but they can move them around a little bit. So this is how ghosts try to interact with the world that we see. They see it too, but they can't interact with it, so they feel frustrated, and that's how they try to do it. And this is why ghosts in general cause fear and frustration for other people, because they themselves, many ghosts don't know that they're ghosts, and they don't know how they became a ghost, and they don't know what to do to stop being a ghost. So they're ignorant as well, and the only thing they know that they can do is cause fear in people. So if that's all you could do, then maybe that's what you would do, because there's not much else open to you. Yeah, she has a question.
Well, if you become a ghost, do you become a ghost forever? Or
no, not forever. In a, you know, there's a whole, Garuda Purana is all about ghosts. Don't read it at home by yourself. But in the Garuda Purana, Garuda asks Vishnu about death and ghosts and moving on to reincarnation in another lifetime. And so Krishna is describing to Garuda all these details, and he's mentioning that people become ghosts sometimes because they're very sinful, sometimes they become ghosts when they commit suicide, and sometimes when the agents of Yamaraj take someone to be punished in the hellish worlds, the person can escape, just like, you know, people escape from the police. But the catch is, if you escape from the constables of Yamaraj while you're being punished, you're being taken to hell for punishment, then you don't get a new gross body until you report to hell to finish up your duration of time there. Then when you finish with hell, then you can go down the regular channel. Of course, in the Garuda Purana, it mentions that if you chant Hare Krishna, it can promote a ghost to a regular form. Even there's a story like that in the Gita Mahatmya, that there was a man, and he was very sinful, and he went to go make some money, and he made some money, but on the way back, robbers found him, and they killed him, and they took his money. And so he became a ghost, and he stayed by a tree. His son found out that something had happened to his father, but nobody knew what had happened to him. He was lost, and so the son went, and somehow or another the son happened to travel right by that same tree where his father was. And the son had this habit of reading Bhagavad Gita every day. And so when the son read some verses from Bhagavad Gita, suddenly the father was released from being a ghost. And he thanked his son for doing that, and, you know, that's in the Gita Mahatmya. But you have many stories like that.
Dhundakari and Dhundakari.
In Srimad-Bhagavatam Mahatmya.
There's also, you know, a story about, in the Garuda Purana, it talks about how people who are kings, specifically they have the ability to release people from being ghosts. So that's another thing. And there's several stories about a king who gets approached by a ghost saying, please say something for me, do a puja for me, and I'll be released from this ghost body. Yeah. So that's another way that they can be released. But of course, if you have a situation, sometimes these things happen. There are many situations all over the world like this where some location will be heavily inhabited by a ghost. And because of that, it'll make it unpleasant for the people who live there. So if you
chant Hare Krishna, or you get a DVD and have it playing the holy name or something over and over again, what will happen is one of two things. The ghost will listen and become purified and be delivered from being a ghost, or the ghost will hate it so much that he'll leave it, leave that area. You know? So naturally, ghosts are usually attracted to a particular place because they died there. And so they have some unfinished business there. That was where they lived their life. That was where something bad happened to them. And that's why they're attracted to a certain place. And, of course, many ghosts are attracted to their, you know, physical body, even though now it's in the ground and rotting away. And that's one of the reasons why in India they cremate the body, because there's no body for the ghost to be attached to anymore. The body's gone. But in Western world, they bury the body, so the ghost remains around where that body is. That's why when you go to graveyards and places like that, there's whole bucket loads of ghosts hanging around the graveyard, because they're hanging around their once physical form. They don't understand exactly what's happened. They don't understand exactly what's happened or how to get free from it. But so some ghosts will become and stay ghosts for thousands of years, whereas some will be moved onward because they hear the holy name, or somebody does a puja for them, or somebody chants Bhagavad Gita, or some kind of thing like that. You have a question, yeah.
Yeah, regarding incarnation, what you were talking about before. I have so many questions about that, right? Because it's also fascinating.
What's that?
There are so many questions about that.
Yeah.
For that thing, do you think people reincarnate in the same geographical area they were before? And how long do you think it has to do with the period of time they would reincarnate again?
Uh-huh. Well, one thing is that the life or time on the Earth plane is different from time in the other planetary systems. So what takes place, you know, in a minute or a second in the heavenly planets may take years and years to happen here on the Earth plane. When a person dies, there's a lot of karmic things that can happen. If the person is actually, to some extent, spiritually oriented, then usually they just take another human birth right away. If they're very sinful, they go to the court of Yamaraj and they get judged by Yamaraj. And then oftentimes they have to do some period of time in the hellish worlds. And then they may even be demoted to an animal body for a certain length of time. And then they have to work their way back up the stepladder of the animal forms back to the human form. So sometimes souls are not so bad that they don't have to go through the animal forms. Sometimes they don't have to go through hell. They can reincarnate right away. Sometimes the soul may die in a peculiar situation, like in a war, and get promoted to heaven. And if they do that, then they're in the heavenly worlds for a while before they come back to the earth plane. So there's a lot of different things that can happen. And it seems to me that there is a sense that certain types of living entities, we have material desires. And that's what our subtle body is all about. What we did in the past and what we really wanted to do. And because those two things are very strong, then if we really liked the place that we were, you know, if we really identified with it, and really that was a major part of what we felt was the joy of our lives and what we focused on, then it's quite likely we'll take birth in the same place again. We may, as Prabhupada says, sometimes we may, you know, man had a skyscraper and he made so many millions of dollars with it, and then he dies because he was sinful. He took birth as a rat in that same skyscraper. Mm-hmm. So now he's still connected with the same thing, but in a different situation. So this is kind of what happens. And of course, some people don't take birth in the same location again, because their material desires were different, and as a result, they may need to take birth somewhere else to make that material desire possible. Someone wants to be a great musician or something like that. So there is a family somewhere living that's very much interested in music and so on and so forth. So he takes birth there, which may be in another location, because that was his main desire. Of course, we have all of our sinful karma, which sometimes interferes with what we want. So we get some advantages toward the material things that we wanted and some disadvantages toward the material things we wanted. But one day we begin to realize that those two things are completely pointless, whether we get advantages toward our material desires or disadvantages to our material desires. What we want to do is learn to serve Krishna and leave the material world altogether. And this way we burn up both good and bad karma, and we dissolve our subtle body and we go back to the spiritual world, which is the real goal of life, not to come up with some material dream, to work hard materially to realize it, and sometimes even to understand scripturally by following some rituals how to get good karma to realize our material dream. These things are all really not important. But that's nevertheless what most people spend their whole lives doing, and why they take birth again and again in various kinds of forms. Does that answer your question? Okay, he has a question.
I have a comment.
Yeah.
So if you chant Hare Krishna Maha Mantra in front or near a graveyard, many ghosts will be
delivered.
Yeah. Yeah. Some will run away and some will be delivered. She had a question.
If we eat prasadam and chant, uh-huh, at least we're guaranteed a human body in our next life, right?
Yeah, if we chant Hare Krishna, we'll at least get a human body. That's one of the things that Prabhupada said. If you commit to being a devotee and you're chanting, then at least you'll get a human body. But, of course, you know, once again, whatever we think about at the time of leaving this body, that state will attain. And because whenever we, there's no loss or diminution in this process of Krishna consciousness, however much we advance in Krishna consciousness, we will never have to go over the same territory again. We will pick up where we left off. So if, as Prabhupada said, if we were 15% Krishna conscious when we died, then we begin the next life at 16%. We make further progress. And that's why at the end of 6th chapter, Arjuna asks the question, well, what happens if I engage in the process of devotional service, but I don't complete it? Don't I lose both materially and spiritually? And Krishna says, no. That if you are engaged in devotional service, you will never be overcome by evil. If you have been engaged for a long time in devotional service, you get born into a family of devotees, those who are already advanced in spiritual consciousness. And so the child then has a head start. If you were not so advanced in spiritual life and you died after a short commitment to spiritual life, then you get born in a rich family where the likelihood is that you won't have to struggle so hard to make a living, and there's more of a chance that you'll continue with your devotional life. So that's the basic idea of those things. Yeah.
Is there a translation to Satchitananda? Is there a translation to it?
Satchitananda? Yeah. Sat means eternity. Ananda is bliss, and chit is knowledge. So the spiritual world is made of three elements, sat, chit, and ananda. In other words, everything in the spiritual world is eternal, knowledgeable, and blissful. But the material world is designed to reverse that. The material energy is asat, achit, and nirananda. So everything in the material world is temporary, miserable, and full of various kinds of ignorance. In other words, things are not what they seem to be. And that's the world we live in, the material world. Well, some other questions I saw.
So I have a question about this. You're talking about hellish planets and different punishment the person, sinful person would undergo.
Uh-huh.
The question is that at the time of death, the gross body is dissolved, and we travel through a subtle body.
Yeah.
So the punishment which are described in Srimad Bhagavatam and the Puranas.
Yeah.
So the person goes there as a subtle body and experiences.
There's
the
actually, I think it's described. I read it or heard it somewhere that. It's basically the subtle body, but there's something special about the subtle body that gets done in the hellish worlds to be able to experience suffering in a extreme way and be able to do it repetitively. Because if we had to experience the kind of suffering in the hellish worlds, in our gross body, it would just die. The gross body wouldn't be able to handle it. But the subtle body, a special version of the subtle body, can handle the repeated sufferings that are drastic that happen in the hellish worlds. And then, of course, going through those sufferings, then one is purified of so much bad karma, and then you get a chance that when you come back to the earth plane again, you don't have so much to work off. You're in a much better situation. You have a question?
When you get, flashbacks of your previous life. Is it because the subtle body does it keep the information from what happened to you?
Yeah, to some extent it does. Mostly it's erased, and that's the whole idea. You know that by the material nature, when we take a new body, most of what happened in the previous body is erased. That way we get a chance to start with a new slate. However, sometimes what a person wants the most, it's based on our material desires, sometimes what a person wants the most is to remember their past life. That's one of the things they want to do. So the material energy allows them to remember it, you know. Most people don't die thinking, the thing I want to do for sure is to remember it, my past life and my next life. Most people don't even know they have a past life or a next life. But occasionally people die, especially people who were being murdered, who think, I want to get this, I want justice for what happened to me. I want to remember it. I want to do that. Because that desire is so strong, when they take birth in a new lifetime, the material energy allows them that memory. But evidently, even people who don't make such a big deal of it, can be moved through it from past life regression. So that means it must be somehow etched there, you know, some kind of way, what the past life is. Just like I can't remember what I did when I was 10 years old, but if I go through a hypnotist, they can bring you to where you can remember things that happened when you were 10 years old. And so if they can remember, you can remember things that happened when you were 10 years old, then you can probably remember things that happened in the past life in the same way, because it's stored somehow or other in the subtle body. That's at least the indication I get. Or maybe it's just known by the actual soul, which knows whatever it needs to know.
Oh.
You have a question. Okay.
Maharaj, is someone who is in a ghost body, are they more similar to humans or animals in terms of being subjected to the laws of karma? Like if they're, you know, doing evil things or like...
No, I get the sense that those in ghost bodies do have some, unlike animals, they do have some concept of what they're doing, and they can be... disturbing or not. I thought I turned it off, but I guess I didn't.
Time to wake up.
No, it was my somebody's calling. I get the sense that because in the Garuda Purana it mentions kings talking with ghosts, and there's other stories of people talking with ghosts and they're having conversations the way regular humans do, which we can't do with animals because animals are,
too much under the modes of nature, so they don't have any free will in the sense that we usually think of it.
So can a ghost accumulate, like, new karma, new good or bad karma?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent they can. They don't have a lot of freedom. You know, they can't really do something drastically evil because they just physically can't do it, you know. But they can certainly create a lot of mischief, and I'm sure they get a certain amount of karma for doing that.
Maharaj, is there any example where people remember from their hellish life in these cases?
I don't think anybody has. I didn't read any account like that. I didn't read this whole book yet. I read about half of it. It's hard to read because it's so kind of scientific and dry, you know. This other one's kind of interesting to read, you know, Soul Survivor, because it's written like a story, you know, you can follow it. But this one's written like a scientific document, you know, like one of those things that you read. It's got graphs and everything, and it mentions, you know, that he talked to the brother, he talked to the brother-in-law, he talked to the wife. And, you know, about this is what they said that was the same, this is what they said that wasn't the same. And
there is a clear correlation between that fighter in Second World War.
Yeah.
And Krishna said that if you die, you will go to heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
But there is, not much example that I know of about other professions we are doing.
Well, that's the whole thing, that Kshatriyas, they have to risk their lives for the safety of the rest of the population.
Yeah.
So if a police, you know, it mentions in the Mahabharata that even if the Kshatriya is sinful or other things, if he dies in battle, none of that matters, they go to heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Or if he's fighting on the wrong side, it doesn't matter.
Prabhupada said, it doesn't matter how many people you kill in war, you'll go to heaven.
Yeah.
Because you're doing for a greater cause.
Yeah, you didn't create the war, you're just acting as a kshatriya. So even if a policeman, you know, dies in action, you know, while he's doing something, he may have otherwise been sinful.
Yeah.
But he'll go to the heavenly worlds.
I read one book, and in that book it has been described that there was a king, Balrampur, you must be knowing.
Yeah.
So that king, he was reincarnated, and then young child, then he started saying, oh, he was the king.
Yeah.
He's the king. No, he was declaring he's the king. And then family decided, okay, let us go to there and see. And he was forcing the family member that, no, go to that place. Why I'm here? I should be in the palace only.
Yeah, right.
So when he went to the palace, people were not treating him just like a king.
Uh-huh.
They were treating like a young boy.
Yeah.
So he was very upset. And then queen, she brought some milk or something for him. And then he told, no, this is not my glass. I used to drink milk in a golden glass.
Yeah.
And this is not my glass. Why you brought it in this glass? So she was surprised, oh, he remembered each and everything. And they had 150 or something servant, and he was knowing each person's by name when he was the king. And then they asked for the example, do you know? Then he started saying, oh, this person is this is the name,
and he
was doing this job for me. So, and when his son came, and then he did not pay the obeisances. Then he told, what kind of
I
have given you culture.
Yeah, yeah.
So you forgot your culture. Like that he was.
That, we get stories like that in this 20 cases by Ian Stevenson, that the little boy, he treats someone who's like in their 40s or 50s, that, like their son, you know.
Yeah.
So it's funny to see a little boy treating an old man like a son, but they have that relationship because he remembers in the past life that was what the relationship was. Yes.
Did you say the subtle body is made of mind, intelligence, and ego?
False ego, yeah.
And false ego. So, and then devotional service dissolves the subtle body.
Right.
So if you're in a human body and you're doing devotional service, but it's also dissolving your subtle body, which is where your intelligence is.
Yes. Well, that's false intelligence.
False intelligence, okay.
So in other words, our subtle body is our suitcase, to use kind of a crude expression, our suitcase full of the things we think we want, the things we think we are, the memories of what we did in this life and past lives, and all of our material sense of what's important and what's not, you know, along with our karma, all that stuff is in there. And devotional service gradually burns all that stuff up. It doesn't mean that we don't have intelligence anymore. Mm-hmm. We have real intelligence. It doesn't mean we have no ego. We have real ego. It doesn't mean we don't have mind. We have real mind. So in other words, what the subtle body is all of our false notions of who we are. And when those become unentangled and finally erased, then we see who we really are. And we're acting as a direct servant of Krishna, as a spirit soul within a human body. And that's called Jivan Mukta, or being liberated even in the material form. And then when we die, because there's no subtle body, there's no spontaneous generation of a new form that we have to go and inhabit now, that because even now we're creating a new gross body. And if we're engaged in devotional service, we're also burning up the subtle body, so we're uncreating it to a certain extent. And basically that's how it works. Does that make sense?
Yes. Thank you, Mother.
That story from the Chaitanya, when Srivas Pandit's son died during the Kirtan time, Mahaprabhu.
Where Lord Chaitanya called the boy back. That's another story, kind of like. Of course, Lord Chaitanya is the Supreme Lord. So Srivas Thakur was engaged in holding a kirtan, I think he did quite often, in his home. And Lord Chaitanya was dancing for hours and hours and hours. And at one point, Lord Chaitanya finally finished. And when Lord Chaitanya finished dancing, he looked around and he said, "Has something happened in this home?" And Srivas Thakur said, "Yes, my son died." And he said, "When did he die?" He said, "Well, he died 5 hours ago when you were dancing." And Lord Chaitanya said, "Why didn't you tell me?" And Shiva said, "I didn't want to disturb your dancing. This is just, you know, in the material world, people come to the material world and people leave in the material world. And so this, my son dying in the home while you were dancing, that's the best thing that could have ever possibly happened to him. So I didn't see any cause for grief." Actually, when the son died, Srivas was informed by his wife, who was crying, and then Srivas went into the room and he got all the servants and his wife and his children together. "If you cry and you make Lord Chaitanya feel anxiety and he stops his dancing, I will kill myself and take poison." So they all stopped crying. And then when Lord Chaitanya found out after he was finished dancing that Srivas' son had died, he went into the room where the boy was, and the mother was still kind of upset, and he spoke to the boy, and he said, "My dear young boy, why have you left so suddenly? Your parents are very attached to you." And the boy sat up and began to talk, and he spoke to the Lord Chaitanya. He said, "My dear Lord Chaitanya, which mother and father are we talking about?" You're talking about the one that I just left. That I've had many mothers and fathers. But you are the Supreme Lord, and you give me a life, and then you take one away. We all are given a material body, and we have it for some time. And then at some point, the material body will be taken away from us. So by your will,
you decided I should move to another body, so therefore I'm happy to follow your bidding. You know, the little boy explains in spiritual terms the whole idea of reincarnation. And when he's finished, then he lies back down and again dies. And so at this point, everyone in Srivas's house is aware that this idea, we have this idea of family members and mothers and fathers and children and husbands and wives, but actually we're thrown together in a world like straws in the ocean, and we take these things very seriously. But when we die, we realize that we never really had any connection, that we come together and then we get broken apart, and we go on to new lives and new situations, and we never necessarily meet again. So this is the actual understanding of our position in the material world. The soul is on a journey through many lifetimes, and through those many lifetimes, the soul encounters many families, and he encounters many situations, and he encounters many good things, many bad things. Sometimes the soul is very happy. Sometimes the soul is miserable. Finally, the soul leaves the body. We call that death. And for most people, the soul goes on and takes another life again, and in a new family, in a new language, a new set of circumstances. And until we decide that we don't want to do this anymore, we want to get free and go back to the spiritual world, then when we do decide we don't want to do it anymore, we have to take up devotional service. And by performing devotional service, we break the cycle of reincarnation. We go back to the spiritual world where we live eternally, and we have eternal relationships with others who are also there eternally, which is what we really want. And of course, Krishna is there. We have a relationship with him. You have a question? Or no?
I can understand a little bit why the scientists deny reincarnation. It's because they don't want to admit the existence of the soul and God, right? Basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. But it's harder to understand why some big religions don't accept that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But that's basic to understand God, right? I think.
Most religions accept a soul, but they don't know what it is exactly. They have a very crude understanding of it. That's why many religions think that animals don't have souls, because they think only humans have souls. You've got theologians like Thomas Aquinas who basically set the idea that there's such a thing as a human soul and animals don't have that, you know. And that's why if you say that animals don't have souls, humans do, then your concept of the soul becomes strange. And if you have the idea that you only live one lifetime, then in the Christian tradition, the idea is that God, every time someone is born, God is creating a new soul. And so it's the first time for that soul, God is creating a new soul. And then at death, that soul is either going to heaven forever or hell forever. So this is some knowledge of soul, but there's many things that are wrong there. And it also is illogical in some ways, you know. So this is the problem, that people have some concept of the soul, but it's very, very confused. So some religious people think like that. Others think there is just the Brahman, and you and I and all of us are Brahman. And when we die, we will melt back into Brahman, and we will be God. Which is another false conception, you know. Yes, we are part of Brahman, but we will never become God. We will just become fragment of God. So the Buddhists say that there is just the false notion that we are an entity, and then we'll become fully realized that we cease to exist. We don't have a soul. We do reincarnate. But what's reincarnating is just our desires. And it's a very strange kind of philosophy because they accept reincarnation, but they don't accept the soul. So what is reincarnating? They have a very strange explanation of what is reincarnating. It's very technical. It's a very strange concept. So these are all kind of slightly mistaken versions of what the soul is, that the soul is God, or the soul is non-existent, or that the body is the soul, and the soul is the body. All these are mistaken things, or animals don't have souls, humans do. Or in the Jewish tradition, you have Jewish souls, and everything else is some other kind of soul. These are all the various ways that you can kind of mess the whole thing up. And when you understand it one of those ways, then it's not logical anymore, and you have problems with explaining the world around.
This way people get different birth and different parts of the planet. For example, some babies are born in wealthy families and
yeah.
greedy and boy and healthy. Some other people is born with diseases in poor countries.
Yeah.
With diseases and that stuff. So if God is just to everybody,
yeah.
he's not being just
to right, right, right.
poor boys, and he's favoring the beautiful boys. Right? And nothing happened without the consent of God.
Right.
So it's...
if you explain that to religious people, they get stuck there. They can't explain why that is. It makes no sense, you know.
It makes no sense, yeah.
One time when during book distribution in New York Union Square,
mm-hmm.
I met one lady, so I was... going to describe her, she just no, I don't want anything, and we have everything. And then I asked her, what kind of concept do you have? Then she told that I forgot that name of the religion, but she told that we are going to have our own family in heaven, our ancestor will be there,
mm-hmm.
neighbor is not going to bother us. We will have our own freedom. Everything will be there.
That's Mormonism, I think.
Yeah, it sounds like a Mormon concept.
I don't remember exactly what
it is. Yeah, yeah. Mormonism is very focused on the idea that everybody will be united with their family. But then the question is, if I am a son in one family and I'm a father in another family, how does that work?
Yeah. You know?
Do I have an eternal small body so that I can always be the son, or do I have an eternal large body so I can always be the father? There's some difficulties with that. In Christianity, there was a big thing for a long time that when a person dies, what happens? You know, some Christian groups say that when the person dies, they just go to sleep until the second coming. And then when Christ comes the second time, then he awakens all those sleeping dead people for however many thousands of years they've been sleeping. And then some go to heaven, some go to hell. Others say that when they die, they go to heaven or hell right away. You know that. But then we have to think, well, if their body's in the dirt, how do they go to heaven? You know, so do they get another body? You know, there's all these questions because there's no scientific knowledge about how it's supposed to really work.
I have a question.
Yeah.
During the after the RT, when we were offering obeisances, uh-huh. and you mentioned Ayodhya. That raised a couple of questions in my mind.
Uh-huh.
And I try to ask the most pertinent one first.
Okay.
I was reading in a book written by Mahanidhi Swami.
Yeah.
Okay. And he may not be something that he said, but it was like in the book. It was just included as something someone said about found in this book. And it was like the question was like, when you're chanting Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, you say Ram Ram, should you be thinking of Balaram or should you be thinking of Ramachandra? And he says, and the answer was, if you're thinking of Ramachandra, well, then you may end up in Ayodhya. And I was thinking, well, that can't be bad, you know.
No, it isn't, no.
But anyway, what are your thoughts about that? And the other question is, how come I've never heard anyone else say, you know, mention Ayodhya in
the Prayavadvani prayers?
Yeah.
Well, there's a kind of general form to the Prayavadvani prayers, but a lot of people add or subtract various things to a certain extent. Usually what we're doing in the Prayavadvani prayers is just offering glories to various aspects of Krishna and Krishna's expansions and their locations where those expansions had their pastimes. So certainly Ramachandra is one of them. As you say, really, we are focusing on Krishna and not on Ramachandra. Technically, I was just reading recently that the other sampradayas, you know, the Nimbarka sampradaya, the Vishnu Swami sampradaya, the Ramanuja sampradaya, those sampradayas basically, for the most part, do worship Lord Ramachandra and not Krishna. Some worship Lakshmi and Sringa, and some worship Lord Ramachandra, but primarily most of the temples focus on Ramachandra and his pastimes. We don't do that because Lord Chaitanya recommended that we worship Radha Krishna. Even though we are not qualified to worship Radha and Krishna, but because we're engaged in devotional service and worshiping the guru or spiritual master, we are worshiping Radha and Krishna. So we don't have anything against Lord Ramachandra. We don't try to turn away from hearing about pastimes of Lord Ramachandra. But our focus is really Radha and Krishna. So that's the best way I can explain it. We don't have any problem with Lord Ramachandra. But our focus is really Radha and Krishna.
Even in the spiritual sky, there is Ayodhya too.
Yeah, right. Actually, I was reading that you have Vaikuntha, and then Vaikuntha is divided into Mathura, Goloka, and also Dwarka. So in Dwarka, you don't have the intimate rasas in their full expansion. But in Goloka Vrindavan, you have all the intimate rasas in their full expansion. You have especially Madhurya Rasa, which is the rasa of conjugal love. That exists in its full expression in Goloka Vrindavan. Whereas in Vaikuntha, in the general Vaikuntha world, you also have Ayodhya. And there you have basically the rasa of neutrality and servitorship and a official version of the rasa of parental affection or friendship or conjugal love. It's an official version. But in Goloka Vrindavan, you have the full version of the three higher rasas, the rasa of conjugal love or Madhurya rasa, the rasa of friendship or Sakya rasa, and the rasa of parental affection or Vatsalya rasa. Because we don't have so much about the there is certainly to some extent information about Lord Ramachandra as a child, and there is an expansion of his relationship with his mother, specifically Kaushalya, and so on and so forth. We do have something there, but it's not nearly as expanded as Yashoda and Krishna is, where we have all kinds of details about that. And so we see it's a fully expanded rasa. Hmm.
And also I think that Gauramandal is also there in there.
Yeah, yeah. In Gauramandal, we have the full rasas. I was just reading that a day or two ago, that there's an expression in Krishna Lila, and then that same person is expressed also in Gaura Lila. So we have some Lila with Krishna and also with Gaura. And so a person may be expressed as a gopi in Krishna Lila, and they may be expressed as one of Lord Chaitanya's associate, male associates in Gaura Lila. And it sounds like the two rasas are happening simultaneously, but I don't really know. I'd have to read it again. I just read it a couple of days ago, and I forget where I was reading it, but it kind of was the first time I'd ever read that. Yes.
Like, there was a discussion that lady talked about her religion, that she will go to her family after death. Krishna, Lord Krishna said, Janti Deva Prata Devan Pritin Janti Pitti Prata. Those who worship the demigods will take birth among the demigods. Those who worship the ancestors go to the ancestors. So what does that mean?
That means they go to Pitra Loka.
So,
which is...
depending on our karma, we are getting different bodies.
So if your ancestors are all materially motivated, then they might wind up in Pitraloka, and then you will similarly wind up in Pitraloka, which is a material location. But if you are actually trying to develop love for Krishna, you'll wind up in the spiritual world, and hopefully your ancestors our relatives will similarly be inclined and eventually wind up in the spiritual world as well, and not Pitra Loka. Yeah.
So, is the demigod world a spiritual world as well?
No. The demigod world is the material world. It's a high form of the material world, but it's still the material world. So, even Brahma Loka and Jana Loka, Maha Loka, Tapa Loka, all these places, they are very wonderful places, Siddha Loka, where people with various purification go, but they're not the spiritual world. And so you have to come back from those places at some point. But if you go to the spiritual world, then you never come back. And the only way to get there is to develop a sense of total dedication to service to Krishna in some form or another.
So it's like an eternal,
Janu, do you have a question? Thank you, Swami.
All right, thank you all very much for
thank you very
kind
much.
Attention. All glories to Srimad Bhagavad-gita. All glories to Vaishnava.
Thank you, Swami Maharaj.
Jai.